All right. Welcome, everyone. There's few seats in here, by the way, for those of you who are sitting there. So excited to be here today at the Marxism Conference. I can't remember attending any of the Marxist conference or any session that I did not find informative and enjoyable. So it's always a great event to attend. Plus, they always have the best speakers. So, before moving any further, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land. It's beautiful land that we are very privileged to be on today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respect to their leaders, elders, past, present, and emerging. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. My name is Noura, as some of you already know, and I'm from Akka. So I don't know if any of you have heard of Akka before. Raise your hand if you heard of Akka. Raise your hand if you've been to Akka. Nice. What's your favorite thing about Akka? Is it the walls? The walls. What about you? The sea, the walls, the ocean. Kim. I saw another hand in the back there. Would you like to weigh in on what's your favorite thing? Back. Good meal. Of course. So food, walls, ocean. But I have to kind of... to agree with Kim that if you ask me, my favorite thing about Akka, without a doubt, is its people. They're very hospitable, very helpful, always ready to jump in and help you. Even if you don't need help, they will come and help you. Very smart, street smart, but also business smart and academia smart, all kinds of smart in Akka. And also they have a very developed sense of humor. So much so that many Palestinians like to make fun of us. So they say stuff like, it's all rumors, by the way, but I'm going to say it in Arabic and then I'll translate in English, right? So they say, Akkawiyyi. So Akkawiyyi means Akkawis, the people from Akka. They, bishrabu shoraba bishoki, which means that they drink their soup with a fork. So they're trying to tell you that we're stubborn, that we are not really good with science. We don't know how physics work. But the way I take it is that we are just very persistent and relentless. That's how I would like to take it. So, yes, I'm from Akka, and I came to Australia 5 years ago. And in those 5 years, I took on probably the most important thing that I will ever do in my entire life. The most challenging but also rewarding position I will ever, or a role I'll ever play, and that is motherhood and parenthood. Yeah. So I'm a mother of two incredibly cute, intelligent, kind, funny, two little boys. And from day one, my boys were identified or categorized as threat from day one. Now, they don't have to engage in politics, and they don't have to engage in activism. They don't have to have an opinion on anything, but the mere fact that they exist from a Zionist point of view is perceived as a threat. Now, think about that. Babies perceived as threat. And it's sad that now, in the 21st century, we have to stand here and advocate for children not to be treated as legitimate targets. It's sad that we have to stand here and say children should not be bombed as they play soccer on the beach in Gaza, like the case of the Bakr children, Ahed, Ismail, Zakaria, Muhammad, 9, 10, 11 years old, playing soccer. Israeli force thinks it's a legitimate target. all massacred. It's sad that we have to sit here and talk about how children should not be abused in prison. Like, it sounds like a no-brainer, but no. We still have, some people still have to do that. It's sad that we need to sit here and talk how children, to begin with, don't belong in prison, be it in Israel or in Australia or anywhere in the world. And that children should not be dehumanized and demonized. So there you go. That's why I'm here today. And this is one of the many moral fails of Zionism. Zionism, as a settler colonial movement, is a very aggressive and very violent ideology, but also practice. And I think it's important when we are talking about Palestine that we apply the right framework so that we get a deeper understanding of what is happening in Palestine, and therefore, what is the right solution? What do we need to do to resolve the issues in Palestine? So settler colonial, as we know here in Australia, a settler colonial ideology is not an isolated event, right? So it's not an event that happens once in history and then it stops, right? So our issue with Israel did not begin in 1967. It's not the invasion, not only the invasion of the West Bank, did not start in 1948. It's not only the Nakba. It actually dates back to the late 19th century with the very first yeshuv. Yeshuv being the Jewish yeshuv or colony, right? The very first Jewish colony. And that is because invasion, 1967, and the Nakba, the catastrophe, the ethnic cleansing, and dispossession of almost 75%, over 75% of the Palestinian people, are structures of settler colonial movements, as Patrick Wolf articulates, right? So Israel is a clear textbook case when it comes to settler colonialism, right? If we look at the myth of the Terra Nullius, right? The empty land, the land with no people for people in the land, also sounds familiar, yeah? If we look at the logic of elimination, it's undeniable. And it's not only it's undeniable, it's planned. Like you can see it in Zionist literature, right? The founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, spoke about it. But also, as Arij Sabah Khoury, and a Palestinian academic in Israel, articulates in her article, Tracing Settler Colonialism, that the very first institutions, the very first Zionist institutions, were very clear about their colonial intentions. So they called themselves, for instance, the first bank was called the First Colonial Trust, something like that. Yeah? The Colonial Trust Company, sorry. The Department of Settlement was called the Department of Colonization. Right? Very clear, you know, from the get-go. And according to Fayez Sayeh, an American Palestinian academic who was the first to frame and apply the settler colonial lens to the context in Palestine, that the national liberation terminology did not start until the 1970s. So it's not that it's not a national, it's not that it's not a clash between two national movements. It is, but it's not primarily a national issue. Right? It's one of the ways in which settler colonialism manifests in this case. Yeah? So today what we're going to do is that we're going to have a very broad, shall we say, 30,000 feet view of two primary questions. The first one is, who are the Palestinian people? Am I doing this live? Okay, so sorry. So the first one is, who are the Palestinian people? And how have they been, or how are they affected by Zionism and the establishment of the Israeli state? And the second one is going to be how does the struggle for justice in Palestine look like today, right? So to start with, if you're looking at the slides, one of the ways in which the Zionist colonial project has impacted the Palestinian people is that it divided people into subgroups. So the Palestinians today live as stateless people scattered all over the world, but also in compartments. So they're compartmentalized, even those that are still in Palestine. Yeah? So let's look at the first group. And the first group is the Palestinians in 1948. So the first Palestinians in 1948, there's approximately 1.9 million, and they're internally displaced people, meaning that no one who is living currently in their respective states or villages are originally from that place. So almost every Palestinian you will ever meet in your life is a displaced person. So 1.9 million internally displaced people, and they live as second-class citizens, and that is something by law. It's not just how we feel, right? This is what the law says in Israel. And of course, Israel has created this system and institutions and structure that is highly discriminatory towards Palestinians. One of the examples, obviously, the most recent nation state law that clearly states that this, you know, Israel, so they stop pretending to be democratic. They're like, we're just going to be clear. Yeah, this is the Jewish people state. This is a nation state for the Jewish people. So that automatically puts the Palestinians in, a subordinate or an inferior category. And we're talking about indigenous people. Other laws, for instance, the right of return, right? You cannot become a citizen if you're a Palestinian, or you cannot return to Palestine if you're a Palestinian. I mean, you can only return or go and live in Israel if you prove that you have Jewish ancestry, right? So again, another discriminatory law. Another law, the law of family reunification. So Palestinians who marry, say Palestinians in Israel who marry non-Palestinians or Palestinians from the West Bank cannot reunite in Israel. So again, with the divide. There's definitely, it's not just the law, it's also the practice, you know, in terms of how the institution practices. Land confiscation is an issue. There's unrecognized villages in the Naqab, or as some of you may know as the Negev, but also in the Jalil, the Galilee, people living, no electricity, no services, no water. Then that is because Israel just decided that, you know, they don't want to recognize the fact that they're there. So this is one of the issues that Zionist colonialism manifests inside Israel. And of course, police brutality. Most recently, there's been a case in Haifa where, you know, again, with the threat, right? The mentality of demographic threat. Palestinians are perceived immediately as a threat. So a mother from Haifa calls the police most recently so that they can help her with her mentally unstable son, who's throwing a bit of a tantrum. He's 33 years old, but he's mentally unstable. And then the mother calls the police only for the police to come and shoot him in the back and kill him. So again, immediately identified as threat, doesn't matter what you do. Moving on to the next category, and that is the Palestinians in Jerusalem. So in terms of citizenship, so it's a tricky, they have a tricky status because they're not citizens of Israel, but they're permanent residents. So they live there minus the citizenship status plus privileges, which is, if you're a Palestinian, I mean, you don't get much. But for instance, like pension becomes an issue, you know, for people in Jerusalem, because, you know, again, legally, they don't have a clear status, or the Israeli government refuses to give them a clear status. There's almost 800,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem. And, you know, the situation in Jerusalem is always, it's one of the most tense, but also most beautiful and, you know, rich cities I've ever been to and I've ever lived in. There's always tension, restrictions and evictions. Like most recently, we have There's an order for evicting and demolishing 28 households in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem, and that would leave 500 people without a home, meaning probably like the same number, possibly, I don't know how many people are there, but like imagine double this number, triple this number, and then think of all these people with nowhere to sleep and nowhere to go. Again, just because their existence is unrecognized and perceived as a threat. The third category is the Palestinians in the West Bank, and that would be 3 million people. They have Palestinian identity cards. And the situation in, so the ways in which settler colonialism manifests in the West Bank is very physical, in the sense that it's, right, it's a physical existence of occupation. So you have the wall, and you have the checkpoints, and you have military presence, and you have all the abuse and exploitation and violence that comes with that military presence on every checkpoint. Again, it's a very like traumatizing experience having, but also very dehumanizing, having to go through checkpoints on a daily basis. Like if you live in, because every city in Palestine is surrounded by checkpoints. So you can't possibly move from one to another without having to go through that experience of, the horror that is called the checkpoint. The other way in which the settler colonialism manifests in the West Bank, that is settlements, right? Further expansion of settlements. And again, this is, recently the ICC issued a statement that they're going to start investigating. And in the preliminary investigation, they found that there's admissible cases for war crimes that are happening in the West Bank, in Jerusalem. And one of those cases are related to changing the demographics in the West Bank. So they're called inner aliyah, right? Inner transfer and inner migration. So the Israeli government is moving people from territories within Israel to territories, to the occupied Palestinian territories in the West Bank. And obviously Jerusalem as well. So the fourth category is the Palestinians in Gaza. And, Gaza, we were talking about the biggest open-air prison in the world. 2 million people living in what's been classified as unlivable conditions, and not because of COVID or not because of poverty. It is because it's totally man-made. It is because of, Israeli occupation, because of Israeli siege. So the siege encompasses land, water, and air, the restrictions on what people can bring in and out of the Gaza Strip. For instance, like shampoo, you can bring shampoo, but conditioner is not allowed. Like, it's so arbitrary and it's so ridiculous that, but this is, racism and colonialism. It's arbitrary and it's idiot. It's an idiotic thing. Of course, siege, in addition to military occupation that are happening, that used to happen, latest one in 2014. And that is something that, one of the ways in which Israel enacts its settler and furthers its settler colonial project. Fifth, it's Palestinians in refugee camps. And I've made that kind of distinction because even though the Palestinian diaspora and Palestinian refugees are counted as almost 6 million, so between 5.6 to 6 million, that's what mainly is being reported. Those almost 1.5 million live in refugee camps in neighboring countries, so in also in Jerusalem, right? Some of them live within Palestine, but also in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. And those who live, for instance, in Lebanon, they live under just hideous conditions where they have absolutely no status other than the UNRWA, the UN issued certificate. There's so many restrictions that are imposed on them. So, for instance, 70 occupation occupations that they cannot work in or study. They can't open a business. You obviously can't own a property. For instance, you can't study meds. You can't open a clinic. You can't be a doctor in Lebanon. So many Palestinians end up leaving to, you know, Europe. And then there is the Palestinian diaspora as well. So the way that the Palestinian diaspora and the refugees are impacted is basically denial of right of return, right? So they're not allowed to, even though the UN has the 194 resolution that states that Palestinians are entitled to return to their homes, still this group of Palestinians denied that right, that internationally recognized right. Right. So next, I would like to talk more about what are Palestinians doing in order to achieve some sort of justice, you know? What are they doing to fight and resist all these horrible things that are being enacted by the Zionist colonial project through the Israeli state? As you can see, I mean, from before and after the establishment of the Israeli state, Palestinians have deployed various strategies in resistance. So from individual to organized, from cultural to armed, it's been very, it's been a wide range. For instance, we look at Palestinians in... Sorry. Okay, so I'm going to be focusing on four main strategies, right? So there is, we spoke about, can I go back to this? That's fine. Anyway, so there I presented in the previous slide a bit of like a mix of what strategies were deployed, but mainly we're going to be focusing on four. So the first one is the strikes. So strikes have always been a part of the Palestinian landscape and history. Most recently, the word strike or the way that it was used, it's become more symbolic. So it's become just strike minus the clash that happens in the street, which is, you know, not exactly what is expected from strikes. But the strike that I would like to highlight and talk about here today is the Palestinian prisoners strike. So Palestinian prisoners... according to Ad-Damir organizations, there are 4,400 Palestinian prisoners currently in Israeli prison, 440 of whom are under administrative detention, and 140 children. So the Palestinian prisoners are, they are an active ingredient of the Palestinian people, and they have many contributions when it comes to the struggle. For instance, there's been individual, but also collective hunger strikes. I don't know if you guys know or remember, but the longest hunger striker, Samir Al-Aissawi from Jerusalem Al-Aissawi, went for 266 days until he was protesting administrative detention. And most recently, there's been Maher Al-Akhras, who's from the West Bank, who went for 100. So that was last year. He went for 103 days until he achieved basically his freedom. The other form of hunger strike that was deployed by Palestinian prisoners is the collective hunger strike. In 2017, it was led by Marwan al-Barghouti, and almost over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners joined, and they went for how many days? I can't remember, but maybe 40-something days. Yes, 41 days. 41 days of hunger strike until they managed to achieve some of their requirements, including visitation rights that were prevented from them. It's important to keep in mind that we're talking about a highly marginalized group within the Palestinian context. Like, of all the Palestinians, they are the most vulnerable and marginalized and targeted ones. There's been reports that almost 100% of all Palestinian prisoners have been subjected to some form of abuse inside the Israeli prison, and including children, like physical, sexual, psychological abuse. So a highly marginalized and targeted group. The second strategy, obviously, is protest. And this is also something that we've been, you know, deploying ever since before the establishment of the Israeli state since 1936, the revolution, all the way to 1976, Land Day, moving forward to the anti-wall protests, second intifada, obviously first intifada, and then anti-wall protests in the West Bank. So in 2012, Israel started building this humongous wall that cuts across and divides Palestinian, literally like families in Jerusalem and the West Bank. And the Palestinian community started organizing, issued a call that was actually answered also by international solidarity movements who went to Palestine and protested against the land confiscation in Blain, Na'lin, Nabi Saleh villages, for instance. Another example is the Great March of Return in Gaza, 2018. Again, Palestinians just started protesting to emphasize their right to return, because again, even in Gaza, almost 70% of the people there are refugees who, you know, whose roots are traced back to Akka and Haifa and Yaffa, and they were just emphasizing that their right of return as well. So it basically included activities as well. For instance, there was a reading chain, there was Dabki, and they also tried to break the siege with boats as well, outside of Gaza. There's also, you know, that there's been solidarity movement coming, trying to break the siege from outside of Gaza. So yes, protesting. And then the last form of protest that I want to talk about is slightly different than the rest. And that is, it's very recent. So this year, at the beginning of this year, there was the Umm al-Fahm. If you guys know Umm al-Fahm, it's probably the largest city inside Israel that is populated by Palestinians. And there's been a movement that started early this year to basically protest police brutality and the crimes that are happening within the Palestinian society in Israel. Now, it's a bit of a societal kind of touch, but because you can't really separate between the social and the political. And there's been, you know, evidence. I mean, the weapon that has been used by those gangs or criminals can be traced to the Israeli military. So, yeah, so things like that. So the people have been protesting ever since at the beginning of the year, every Friday, inspired by the Arab Spring style. Every Friday, they would go and just protest. And obviously, their protests have been met with extreme violence by Israeli military. Next two strategies. Messed up something. So the next two strategies that I want to highlight today is the BDS and civil society, the role of civil society organizations in Palestine. And the last one is advocacy. But the slide is refusing to move. Anyways, we'll get there someday. So let's start talking about civil society organizations and the key role or the crucial role that they play within running the whole sector, for instance, in the West Bank. The whole West Bank is highly dependent on civil society organizations. And that is because of the vacuum that was created, you know, being under occupation, but also that also resonates and is reflected the same for Palestinians inside Israel. Because, you know, as second-class citizens, you don't really get much services. And there's a network of civil society organizations that is highly highly capable and highly professional when it comes to like cultural needs, when it comes to tending to those needs that you know, the government neglects or chooses not to basically respond to. So one of the calls that was issued by the Palestinian people in the West Bank was the BDS, the boycott, divest, and sanction. And this is a non-violent strategy to put pressure on Israel so that it abides by international law and ends human rights violation in Palestine. So this strategy does not really address a solution. It just tells people that this is what you can do if you don't want to be complicit. There's a way for you to contribute, and this is a strategy that everyone can take part in, not just Palestinians, even non-Palestinians and allies as well. And the last one that I'm going to be addressing today is the advocacy. And this is also, and probably will highlight the role of the diaspora in here. In terms of, you know, internationalizing the cause, connecting to other social movement justice, again, exposing all the misinformation that happens in the media around Palestine. I mean, even here in Australia, like, you know, that watching as a Palestinian watching news coverage. Because, like, for me, it's an exact translation of what Channel 2 in Israel says. So they just take whatever story, whatever the narrative is in the Israeli news, and they just present it to everyone here in Australia. And we need to keep in mind that the Israeli media is highly censored by the Israeli military. So you're not even getting what really the Israeli people think. This is the version of the Israeli military that you're receiving. For instance, with the recent murder of Ahmed Ariqat, he was driving a car on his sister's wedding day. He was trying to go pick his sister from the hairdresser so that he can go back. But he was shot at the checkpoint, and he was denied medical treatment as well. So he was just shot, killed, and left there to bleed. And the coverage was none of this. The coverage was that a terrorist suspect was killed at the checkpoint, somewhere in the West Bank. So again, we're not talking about balance. It's definitely imbalanced. It's more of just adopting the Israeli army official story. So that's extreme. So in terms of solutions, right? So what are we going to do now? I mean, we have all these Palestinians scattered all around the world. And we have all types of solutions, one-staters, two-staters, no-staters, what do we do? How do we fix this? And I think the key to fixing, or the key to providing solvency, is addressing the root cause of the problem, right? Is giving it, looking at it from the right framework, but also making sure that for a sustainable solution, we need to address the entirety of the Palestinian experience. And that means that we need to address the needs of each and every one of the categories that I presented at the beginning: Palestinians in 48, Palestinians in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in the diaspora, and refugee camps. All of these people need to be included in whatever solution that we're thinking of. I know, yes, the pragmatists will say, how are you going to do that? That's almost impossible. It's really hard. You're divided all over the globe. And, to those people, I say, if we are the kind of people who are capable of somehow getting the fork to carry soup, enough soup for us to drink, we will definitely get there. We will make sure that we will achieve justice and peace and equality and freedom, so that our kids are not identified as threats, and so that they're seen for the beautiful potential that they have in them, and that we can just live in our land in peace. Thank you.